Lee, are you taking the chair?
Yes, I can. How many people are on you?
Good morning. Good morning.
Morning, morning, ma'am.
I'm sorry to go to because when I spoke to the chairperson this morning, well, even though we were using the WhatsApp, I thought maybe he's in, but he mentioned that he's not well today. So if I get cut off because I'm at the rural place, whereby yesterday I had to take my brother to the hospital. So where he stays, there's no Wi-Fi. So, but I'll request the Honorable Linda Moss if I get cut off, and then she can proceed with the meeting. Okay, I could see the agenda. Let me just open the meeting and welcome you all to this meeting. As I've already mentioned that I'm at the wrong place, but bear with me, honorable members, that maybe if I didn't quite get cut off, and then we'll proceed. But I will request the honorable Moss to, if I get cut off, and then she can proceed with the meeting. Kuleko, apologies.
Hi,
item
Chair.
Number two.
Yes, Chair. Good morning, Chair, and good morning to everyone present. The only apology we have is from Mr. Karim.
Okay. Okay, that's fine. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I can't see this agenda very well.
Next point on the
I'm sorry, I made a mistake by not welcoming the National Treasury, which is with us this morning. Let me welcome you people. I'm sorry for that. National Treasury.
Thank you, Honorable Jay.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm just going to be fast because I'm afraid, as I've already said, I can get cut off because there's no Wi-Fi, there's a problem of network here. Let me go straight to item number three, which is briefing by National Treasury on the tax bills. I just want to find out who's the leader of the National Treasury.
Hi, Honorable Jay, it's Chris Axelson. I'm the acting DDG for Tax and Financial Sector Policy. I'm here with the team.
Okay. You may proceed.
Okay, thank you very much. Chair, Warren, are you able to share the slides? Oh, you don't have sharing rights. Oh, I see I've got sharing rights. I can try.
I've just given Warren sharing rights. He can share now.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much. I'll go through the first couple, and then Nhlanhla, I think we'll take over and then start driving the presentation. Okay, so thank you very much, Honorable Members, Honorable Chair. This is our presentation on the tax bills that we have put together for the year. If you go back one slide, Warren, just in terms of what we do, we have a lot of multi-year projects which take a long time to get through. For example, the two-pots reform, the carbon tax incentives as well. They will eventually lead to legislation, but they don't happen immediately. Then we have a lot of the budget announcements which do require amendments within year, and those happen each year. So either we adjust the personal income tax tables or excise duties. We also have a lot of technical updates and some new incentives. And then we put through a draft legislation that reflects both those multi-year projects and the budget announcements. So this year we have a rates bill. We also have a revenue laws amendment bill, which includes the two-pot retirement system. The rates bill includes all the changes to the tax rates that we put in the budget, and then the taxation laws amendment bill has the much more complicated and technical measures included, as well as the tax administration laws amendment bill, which is presented by SARS. Thank you. Next slide. So this basically covers those bills, and in terms of what I said, I'm sure we can go to the next one. And then we'll go through these different rates bills. My colleague in Shansha, Radebe, will go through the different bills, and then we'll call on different colleagues to present in their particular areas. Thank you, Honorable Members. Isn't Shansha here? I do apologize. We are double booked with a presentation to the standing committee at the same time. So Inshansha might be in the other meeting, so I can maybe continue. So this year, we do have the 2023 Revenue Laws Amendment Bill, which we published on the 9th of June for draft. We had the TLAB, which we published on the 30th of July, and the TALAB at the same time. We then take comments on both of those bills. We try and revise the bills, and then we have tabled those bills at the medium-term budget policy statement a few weeks ago, 3 weeks ago exactly. And next slide. And I'm sure the members will know we've got two different types of bills. We've got the money bill, and we've got the Section 75, which are administrative bills. And I suppose we do this slightly different to other types of bills, where a lot of other bills are submitted to and tabled in Parliament, and then comments are done and the departments present on those bills. We try and do it before tabling so that we can get a lot of the difficult and major changes into the bill before they are tabled. So we previously did workshops with stakeholders on the 6th to the 8th of September. Then we revised the bills, and then we presented a response document to the standing committee on the 25th of October. So that includes all the proposed changes that we were making to the draft bills after consultations with all the stakeholders. And then we tabled the bills. And next slide. And then I'll get into the initial rates bills. I think my colleague Marley is here, and she can take you through these slides. Thank you. Marley?
Chris, okay, I don't know if Marley's on the call. Sorry to interrupt. I don't know if she's with Inflantler, but I'll check with her quickly.
I can see her, but it's all right. I'll do these as well. Okay, so in terms of the personal income tax tables, this is our largest tax instrument that brings in the most amount of revenue for the government. We increased all the brackets by the estimated value of inflation at 4.9%. This was to make sure that there was no bracket creep, where people would earn a higher income that's in line with inflation but be pushed into higher brackets. So we increased those all by 4.9%. Similarly, the medical tax credits were increased by the same amount of 4.9%, from 347 Rand per month to 364 for the first two members, and 234 to 246 for any additional members. And next slide. We also this year adjusted the retirement tables and the transfer duty tables. We don't adjust these each year, so we only do it on an ad hoc basis. So every 2, 3, 4 years, we will look at these tables and then adjust for inflation over the period. And this year, we increased those by 10% to try and cater for inflation that has occurred over the past a few years, but when they weren't adjusted. So the transfer duty tables there on the left, you can see all those brackets went up by an amount of 10%. And the two different retirement fund lump sum tables on the right also increased by 10%. That's the tax that you would receive on lump sums from retirement, either before retirement, which is at a higher tax rate, or at retirement, which is at a lower tax rate. Thank you. We also increased the excise duties on alcohol and tobacco by the expected inflation rate of 4.9%. There is a guideline there in terms of where we try to achieve A weighted average retail price of 11% for wine, 23% for beer, and 36% for spirits. We are slightly above those guidelines, but this year we have also increased those by inflation. Our guideline was always that we try and increase the excise duties to get to those percentages, and if not, we increase by inflation. Next slide. Umpo, do you want to go through these? I see I've gone on to your slides as well.
Thanks, Chris, and good morning, Honorable Chair, and good morning, Honorable Members. Here, it is with regards to the inflationary adjustment to the health promotion levy that was announced in the 2022 budget for implementation from the 1st of April of 2022. But the minister made an announcement with regards to the postponement of that inflationary adjustment to the health promotion levy for 2022-2023 financial year. But further on this year, the minister made another announcement to further postpone that inflationary adjustment to the health promotion levy for another 2 years, meaning that there's not going to be that increase that was announced in 2022 will not be affected in this financial year and the next financial year, giving a 2 year a suspension of that inflationary adjustment to the health promotion levy, and that is to give the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition some time to be working on the sugar master plan that they've put together to assist the sugar growers industry to diversify and considering the challenges that they have faced. And then also part of that announcement was that there's going to be a discussion paper that is going to look at the inclusion of fruit juice and the possibility of lowering the current threshold of 4 grams per 100 mils that is currently part of the excise structure for the health promotion levy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Umpo. Is Alvina or Basil here?
I'm here, Chris.
Thanks, Alvina. Would you like to go through these?
Thanks, Chris. Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. I'll take you through the two-part system-related changes. So this slide deals with the different retirement funds that we have in South Africa in terms of the different tax treatments and the different rules for withdrawals prior to the reform that we started in 2012. So since then, we have all harmonized the tax treatment of contributions and also the withdrawal rules by allowing preservation for Provident Fund benefits since March 2021. Next slide. So with the two-part system, we are trying to address two primary concerns with regards to the current system. The first concern being lack of preservation before retirement. This is evidenced by members of pension funds and provident funds that are able to access their benefits when they change jobs. Secondly, we have provident pension fund members that have savings in their funds, but they're not able to access these funds in cases of emergencies. So in an attempt to address these two concerns, we have proposed the two-part system. The tax system will remain largely the same. We are not changing that with this two-part system. Next slide. So this slide speaks to what we are not changing, which is the tax deduction for retirement fund contributions. It will stay as it is, being the lesser of 350,000 up to 27.5, whichever of the higher taxable income or remuneration. 37D deductions proposal is that they'll be permissible against the vested and the retirement component This was in the first draft that we released for public comments. Area contributions will follow the same rules if those area contributions emanated pre-implementation period. They will be allocated to the pre-implementation period, which is the vested component. If they arise post-implementation, they will be attributed to the two-part system. Next slide. So moving on to the proposals of the two-part system, we are proposing that the two-part system creates a seed capital. This will allow for immediate access when the implementation of the two-part system starts. Seed capital refers to a starting balance that we propose that it be put in the savings component when the new system starts. The proposal being 1st March 2025 as the implementation date. This will allow sort of a starting balance in the savings component allocated from what a member has saved when the new system starts, which would be in the vested component, a transfer from the vested component into the savings component. The proposal is to limit the seed capital to the lesser of 10% of a vested component, which is what a member has saved, up to 30,000. The intention is that this should not limit, should not erode the retirement savings, but should allow emergency access to retirement savings. Next slide. The two-part system will create a savings component on or from March 2025, which we are proposing to be the implementation date. So this savings component will house one third of a member's total retirement fund contributions. So assets in the savings component will be available for withdrawal. A member need not resign to have access to what is in the savings component. And remember the previous slide, the savings component will start with a seeding capital of what a member has accumulated of the less of 10 up to 30,000. Withdrawals in this savings component will be allowed once within a year of assessment. The member can, however, not withdraw anything less than 2,000 rand. Next slide. So in the event that a member resigns from employment and what they have in the savings component is less than 2,000 rand, they will be able to take whatever is left in the savings component. If a member belongs to a number of funds or has a number of retirement fund contracts, the savings component will be applicable per fund or per contract and not per member. Withdrawals from the savings component will be at a member's marginal tax rate. And in the event that the member passes on, their beneficiary will have the option to either receive the benefit in the savings component as a lump sum or transfer that benefit to the retirement component and get it as an annuity. Next slide. The two-part system also creates a retirement component. This will house contributions from the implementation date of two-thirds of a member's total retirement fund contributions. The retirement component will have to be preserved until retirement, so no withdrawals will be allowed from the retirement component. Once a member reaches retirement age and retires, the retirement component has to be paid in the form of an annuity, subject to the de minimis threshold, which is currently 165,000, meaning that if a member has accumulated more than 165,000 in that retirement component, it has to be paid as an annuity or a pension. Next slide. So if a member leaves the country and ceases to be a tax resident of South Africa, they will be able to withdraw what is in the retirement component. subject to the three-year rule that currently applies to all members of funds, Provident Preservation and Retirement Annuity Fund. Next slide. The third component that the two-pot system creates is a vested component. So this component refers to a value of what a member has when the two-pot system comes into effect. So funds will have to value what a member has contributed or the fund benefit that the member has when the two-pot system starts and house it in the vested component. Next slide. Members will not be able to make further contributions into the vested component. So once the two-pot system is in place, members will contribute into the savings component, one third of their retirement contributions, and the retirement component, two thirds of their contributions. So no further contributions will go into the vested component unless if a member is a Provident Fund member who was 55 years and older on 1 March 2021. So these Provident Fund members will have the option of either continuing contributing into the vested component or choosing to take up the two-pot system. If they decide to remain in the vested component, their contributions, all their contributions will be allocated in the vested component. If they choose to take up the two-pot system, they will not be able to contribute into the vested component. Their contributions will be split in terms of the savings and their retirement component. Next slide. So amounts that are in the vested component, I've mentioned it's a vested right. They will be treated in terms of the current rules. It's all that a member has accumulated when the two-pot system comes into effect. So the current rules of the vested component is that when you resign, you are able to withdraw or transfer to your prospective fund. When you get to retirement, depending on the de minimis threshold, you are able to take one third as a cash lump sum and two thirds as an annuity. Again, vested components are also withdrawable when a member ceases to be a tax resident of the country, subject to the three-year rule. Next slide. So the two-pot system will apply to all funds. This includes public sector funds and our biggest public sector fund, which is a defined benefit fund. So it's proposed that the two-pot system also applies to DB funds. And because DB funds are not the same as defined contribution funds, they use a defined formula. They do not reference contributions and investment performance. So we are having a special dispensation for defined benefit funds where they will be required to calculate their one-third contributions to the savings component with respect to one-third of a member's pensionable service and two-thirds of a member's retirement component with respect to two-thirds of a member's pensionable service. Seed capital will also be allowed for defined benefit funds. So in terms of the pensionable service, say, for example, post-implementation date, a member has 3 years after implementation date. 1 year will be treated as a savings component if a member wants to withdraw, with the 2 years being allocated towards a retirement component and not accessible. Next slide. Okay, we received comments that it might be a challenge for legacy retirement annuity funds to comply with the two-pot system. We are therefore proposing that legacy retirement annuity funds be excluded. However, the exclusion will be an exemption application, which is not a blanket exemption. these legacy retirement energy funds will have to have certain features that the FSCA will look at to ensure that they comply to be exempt from the two-pot system. Next slide. The two-pot system still allows members to transfer either between funds or within the fund. So a member is able to move their benefits or their contributions from the savings component to the retirement component, but the funds can't move the other way. A member can move money from the retirement component into the savings component. A member can also move funds from the vested component into the retirement component, but not the other way, meaning not from a retirement component to a vested component. When a member changes jobs, they are allowed to transfer. Money can only move out of a fund if a member retires or resigns from their fund. So a member can't split their pots in different funds that they are not actively contributing into while they are contributing in another fund. And should a member choose to make a fund-to-fund transfer, all the components have to move. So if a member resigns from one employer and decides to transfer instead of cashing out, they will have to transfer all the three components if they have all three components. If they have a vested component as well, they will have to transfer all the components from one fund to the next fund. Next slide. Yeah. So transfers from savings to savings, from fund to fund, they will be tax-free. And to effect transfers, a fund will have to obtain a tax directive. Next slide. Okay, thank you. I think, this slide. So, following the last bill that we published for comments and taking into consideration public comments as well as comments received through public hearings through the Standing Committee, we have proposed that the effective date be postponed. The initial seed capital was 25,000. The proposal is to increase it to 30,000. However, the 10% will remain, meaning that seeding is proposed to be 10% up to 30,000, whichever is lesser. We've clarified that for Provident Fund members, the default is that they stay contributing in the vested component and they have a choice to go into the two-pot system. That choice, however, is not reversible. For legacy retirement funds, we have clarified the definition in the legislation to include certain features which were not covered initially. Thank you.
Thanks, Sabina. Male or Hayden?
I'm happy to come in, Chris. It doesn't seem like Mole is audible again, so she asked me to come in. Good morning, honourable members, and I'll be taking you through the two incentives in respect to renewable energy. So as you'll all be aware, we are facing an energy crisis as a country, and government has put together a package of measures to try and encourage investment in different types of renewable energy. So for individuals, there's a solar energy credit for that seeks to encourage individuals to invest in solar panels. And for businesses, we currently have an incentive in place that encourages investment in renewable energy, but we've proposed to temporarily enhance that so that businesses are encouraged to respond and invest. So these are both going to be temporary to try and encourage investment as soon as possible. For individuals, they'll have 1 year to claim, and for businesses, they'll have 2 years. So for the personal income tax incentive, individuals who pay income tax will be eligible to claim, and businesses who are registered for corporate income tax, as well as sole proprietors who calculate business income for their personal income tax, will be able to claim. In respect of the personal income tax incentive, if you invest, you can claim 25% of the value of how much you invest in solar PV panels. And this is up to a minimum of 15,000 Rand per individual. With respect to businesses, what we currently have in the system is that if you spent 100 Rand, you would be able to deduct 50 Rand in year one, 30 Rand in year two, and 20 in the following year. However, what we've proposed is that for a 2 year period, if you invest 100 Rand, you're able to deduct 125 Rand from your taxable income. You can go to the next slide, please. And for the incentive, there are various requirements. So you'll see there are requirements in terms of the panel's capacity. It must be installed at a residence and used mainly for domestic purposes for the solar energy credit. And it must be brought into use between the 1st of March this year and the 29th of February next year. For businesses, the assets must be new and unused because the objective of the incentive is to add to supply. It must be owned or acquired by that taxpayer, and it must be brought into use for the first time from March this year and before March 2025. And then we also have recruitment provisions, which have actually been removed in respect of the individual incentive because it was deemed too administratively complex. But to discourage taxpayers in the business space from reselling that equipment soon after buying it, there is a recruitment provision, which would mean that taxpayers would have to include that amount in their taxable income. Next slide. All right, so I think that's fine as an overview, and perhaps we'll take questions if there are at the end. But just to reiterate again that both of these measures are in response to the severe energy crisis that is being experienced by the country. And so tax incentives are one part of the package, but you might be aware that, for example, the government has also proposed the Energy Bounce Back Scheme, which allows individuals and SMMEs to also source debt financing to enable them to benefit from these incentives. So thanks very much, Chris. I think that's fine for now.
Thank you. Is Nshantle here?
Thank you, Chris. Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. On this one, we're reviewing the practice note 31 that was issued some time back in 1994. And then on 16 November, then the SARS stated that they informed the public that they want to withdraw this practice note. And then subsequent to that, we made some changes in the July version that was published for comment. And subsequent to that, we also then made changes to cater for the comments that were actually stated by some members of the public. However, we made a concession that we possibly have to delay this amendment to Section 11G until 1 January 2021 to engage with the stakeholders in this regard. Thanks, Warren. The next slide. Okay, this one was the amendment that was made to Section 23M. And the key issue was that this, we're just making minor issues there. We're trying to tweak some clarification because the changes were made in 2021. However, we made few changes in the 2023 version. We made some few changes to the definition of creditor, and it wasn't a major changes in this regard. Next slide. Next slide. This one, Chair, here we're making an amendment to exempt a deposit insurance scheme to cater for after government has actually established a deposit insurance scheme in 2022, or first because the announcement was made in 2020. However, then subsequent to that, then we were informed by Reserve Bank that the entity has been established, and then we had to exempt it from tax. Next slide. Subsequent to the changes, subsequent to the public comments, we received comments from the banks as well, asking that can we also extend this exemption to VAT. So now we actually done that, Chair. Thank you. Next slide. This one, Chair, was in relation to foreign business establishment where a South African company has a subsidiary offshore, and then that subsidiary offshore then outsource its activities to either to other companies, either offshore or within that country. However, it was mainly driven by a case, the case called Coronation case. That case went to Supreme Court of Appeal, and the decision was in favor of SARS, such that it was actually stating that the current rules that are there in the Income Tax Act are fine. And then we then decided to withdraw this proposed amendment pending the constitutional case. Thanks, Chair. Warren, next slide. Thank you.
Okay, Hayley, would you like to come in?
Sure.
Anne?
Arnie, sorry. Either.
It's fine. I can go ahead, Chris. So this was in respect of the royalty rate for oil and gas companies. So currently, the government levies royalties on anyone extracting minerals and resources, and this is to compensate government for the extraction of non-renewable mineral and petroleum resources within South Africa. And for oil and gas companies, for mining companies as well, the royalty rate is based on a formula and it adjusts according to the company's profitability. So what happens is the royalty rate is determined by profitability and it's then applied to gross sales. And the rate ranges from a minimum of 0.5% to a maximum of 5%. So if a company has really high profits, they might be faced with a 5% royalty on their sales. In December 2021, a discussion document was published on the Treasury website, which was basically reviewing this oil and gas regime. And in that document, it was proposed that a flat rate royalty replace the current variable royalty rate for oil and gas. So that was based on information that we received from geological sources in terms of what is deemed to be available in South Africa, as well as modeling in terms of oil prices and so on. But following that, there was a public consultation, and it was then proposed that we rather retain the flexible royalty rate, which is based on profitability, instead of a flat rate. And this was really to recognize that companies face varying costs and profit levels depending on where they are. So if you have one company, for example, operating in deep waters, which is more common in South Africa, versus that in shallow water, then their cost profile is obviously much higher, and it makes sense to rather consider their profitability. If you apply a flat rate, the particular resource they're trying to extract might no longer be viable. So to ensure that the country is still adequately compensated for the loss of its finite resources, what was proposed is that the minimum royalty rate would be increased. So instead of it ranging from 0.5 to 5%, the proposal is that it now ranges from 2% to 5%. To ensure that government is better compensated for losing its finite resources. Thank you. Okay, I'll continue with this one. So I've said much of this in respect of the renewable energy incentives with the table that we provided an overview on. So this slide just provides a background on the existing incentive that we have. And then if you go to the next slide, perhaps the one point to highlight here that I didn't earlier is that while the individual tax incentive focuses on rooftop solar investments, for businesses, it's wider. So it encourages investment across types of renewable energy. So that includes wind power and solar PV energy, as well as concentrated solar energy, and also hydropower and biomass comprising organic waste, landfill gas, or plant material. So perhaps just useful to highlight that, if you can move on to the next slide. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Anisa or Umpo.
Thank you so much, Chris. This proposed amendment related to the telecommunications industry. Now, initially, in the early years with the telecommunication industry, subscribers would purchase prepaid vouchers and would be able to use it against services by the telecommunication industry itself, which related to calls and short messaging services or SMSs. Since the advancement of technology, telecommunications industries have also evolved, and as such, are now able to offer services by third-party companies. These would be, for example, financial services, life and non-life insurance, downloads of music, movies, and even money, mobile money services. So in terms of the current provisions of the VAT Act, Section 1019, the telecommunications supplier was required to declare output tax and in the tax period when the voucher was sold either to a retailer or an agent. And then the retailer or agent would then on-sell the vouchers to the consumers. Next slide, please. So since the evolvement of the industry, what happens now is that the telecommunications supplier's output is triggered when the sale happens to the retailer. When the retailer sells it to the consumer, and the consumer then changes the use and is able to then purchase services from third parties, those would either be further taxable or exempt supplies. It would mean that the fiscus would then receive output tax twice, once from the telecommunications company at the point that the voucher is sold, and second from the third party to the extent that the services are taxable. Now, in order to give the telecommunications company an opportunity to be able to balance out that VAT and to ensure that the fiscus does not receive output tax twice, we are proposing an amendment that would require, would give the telecommunications an opportunity to deduct the input tax to the extent that the services were acquired from a third party. Now, the response to this was quite positive. And the only concern raised was had to do with practicalities, which we then said between National Treasury and SARS, we would meet with the industry to discuss the practicalities of information required for credit notes. That's the main thing from the VAT. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Charlene here?
Good morning, Chris. I'll speak to the carbon tax issues. Thank you. Good morning to the honourable members and to everyone who's on the call. So in terms of the Carbon Tax Act defines the tax base according to the greenhouse gas emissions that are reported to the DFFE. These emissions are reported according to the National Greenhouse Gas Emissions Reporting Regulations, which were gazetted in terms of the National Environmental Management Act, or the NEMA, of 2004. The DFFE also published the methodological guidelines for quantifying greenhouse gas emissions to provide for the approach for companies to report the greenhouse gas emissions. So these guidelines work in tandem with the regulations in terms of how companies will report emissions based on the activities and based on the input and the emissions that are produced during the activities. In October of 2002, the DFFE gazetted amendments to the methodological guidelines. These amendments included an inclusion of tier two or domestic emission factors for carbon dioxide, as well as default emission factors, which were updated for fugitive emissions based on the IPCC 2019 refinement study. So in the TLAB, in order to align the Carbon Tax Act with the guidelines, there was a proposal to add Table 1 and Table 2 to Schedule 1 of the Carbon Tax Act. This is to provide for the Tier 2 or domestic emission factors, as well as the emission factors for fugitive emissions. You can go into the next slide, please. Thank you. So after consultations with stakeholders and the comments that were received, and also to ensure that there is appropriate alignment of the Carbon Tax Act schedules to the DFFE technical guidelines, it is proposed that the table for country-specific or Tier 2 emission factors is withdrawn from the TLAB, and further consultations will be held with the DFFE and SARS on the application of these domestic emission factors, and as well as the determination of the appropriate net calorific values to be used for the different fuel types and for the calculation of greenhouse gas emissions. It is also proposed that the table for default emission factors for fugitive emissions is withdrawn, and further announcements to this regard will be made in budget of 2024. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mpo.
I think I'll also speak to this, Chris. So in light of the electricity crisis, as well as which was referred to earlier on in the presentation, a refund for the diesel refund, which currently is implemented for farming, forestry, and mining sectors, will be extended for manufacturers of foodstuffs for the RAF levy for diesel used in the manufacturing process. The RAF will be for food manufacturers in respect of a new item subject to the new Note 14. The refund will apply for the purchase and use of distillate fuel for the manufacturing of foodstuffs during the period of 1 April 2023 to 31 March 2025. Companies or persons may apply for the new refund for the purchase and use of the fuel for the manufacturing of foodstuffs, and the companies or persons that have successfully applied for the refund for the manufacturing premises should register for the purposes of the refund under item 670.05 that are also registered for VAT purposes. The listed manufacturing activities must be reported by the registered refund user at the registered manufacturing premises in the realization of foodstuffs for commercial gain. Thanks, Chris. I think that is the last slide. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Brian's can come in from SARS's side now.
So thank you very much. Thank you, Chair, and good morning to the Chair and honourable members. So starting off with one set of amendments dealing with money laundering, members will be aware of the response and the legislation that was put through Parliament last year. And if we move on to the next slide, you'll see that one of the innovations that was introduced was to bar certain individuals from acting as trustee of a trust or as a director of a company and so on, if they were convicted of certain types of offences, removed from office for breaches of trust, essentially. So That is a concept that is now being also incorporated into the public benefit organization, recreational club, and so on space, to ensure that you do not have these high-risk individuals essentially acting through a PBO or other entity when they couldn't do so in the form of a trust, for example. So that gives us a degree of consistency across the various organizational types. All right, this is a development. Internationally, transfer pricing is a significant issue, but it's also a complicated issue for companies because they have to get the prices right. And a feature that exists in many tax systems is that you can come forward to the revenue authority ahead of time, and you can essentially agree how you're going to be pricing certain transactions. So it doesn't come as a surprise when the revenue authority audits you and comes to a different result. So these are known as advanced pricing agreements. And so what is proposed in this set of amendments, and moving on to the next slide, after a good deal of public consultation, is that there is an enabling provision in the Income Tax Act to empower SARS to enter into advanced pricing agreements. So most of the advanced pricing agreements will involve another tax authority. So it's important to be able to consult with them. And so the legislation provides for that. And those would be what are known as bilateral. In other words, two countries getting together, or multilateral, where you have multiple countries getting together to agree on how they would approach a particular pricing of transactions. And so the slide there just sets up the basic framework. So transfer pricing as a whole requires some scarce resources, and advanced pricing agreements would be no different. So our current thinking is that we would start with a pilot program on a small scale, just so that we can get our learnings once the legislative framework is in place. And we would start off with bilateral APAs so that we could learn from other authorities on a manageable basis. And then once those learnings have been taken on board and we're in a position to extend it, we would then do so, probably moving out of a pilot into a broader set of bilateral APAs, and then ultimately potentially unilateral and multilateral APAs. Now, the underlying text here shows you where there have been some changes from the original draft bill and the final bill as introduced by the minister. So there was a good deal of comment about the fact that perhaps the original language was a little bit too inflexible and that more should be left to secondary legislation around the exact criteria that would be applied. And, that's a suggestion that was accepted, and that has been done. And then the other point that was made was that although the original thinking was that we would only do bilateral and multilateral APAs, there were potentially some cases, although we think they would be relatively few and far between, where unilateral APA, in other words, an APA that only involves South Africa, would be appropriate. And so the legislation has been amended in the introduced version so that a unilateral APA is possible. Moving on to the next slide. This was a proposal that probably got the most attention out of all of them, with APAs coming close second. And this relates to an alignment to require foreign employers to register for employees' tax in South Africa. And the idea was to try and get a degree of consistency between local employers and foreign employers. And there were a number of issues that were raised around this. So the bill as introduced adds a little qualifier there, which makes this a much more focused intervention, which is that the non-resident employer needs to be conducting a business through a permanent establishment in South Africa. So essentially a permanent establishment is a place of business in South Africa that has a degree of permanence around it, hence the name. And so once that exists, it's very hard to criticize the idea of asking those employers to register, because they do have a presence in South Africa. They are active in South Africa. And as the second bullet notes, it's
completely consistent with the kind of approach that is adopted in the Companies Act, where, again, if you are going to be conducting business in South Africa, you are expected to register an external company. Now, their test is perhaps a little bit different from ours in the permanent establishment, although there's a great degree of overlap. And the reason that's important is that obviously the tax system doesn't just deal with companies as employers, it deals with trusts as employers, it deals with individuals as employers. And so we use the internationally understood term being a permanent establishment, which would be understood by anyone who's ever had to look at a double taxation. Moving on. This is essentially a concession. So what happens is sometimes if you're working overseas, so this is the opposite side of the coin. Here we have a foreign employer with employees in South Africa. Now we go the other way around. We have a South African who is working overseas for a South African employer, and they have foreign tax deducted. When can they claim the credit? So the idea here is to allow the commissioner to take that foreign tax paid into account when employees' tax is calculated, and this has been generally welcomed. Moving on. This is a customs intervention. The idea here is that we try to ask for the information once, and so the idea is rather than submitting information to Department of Home Affairs and to SAR separately, we enable a structure where you can submit the information directly to Home Affairs and Home Affairs shares it with us. And so essentially, as it says, a single window, and again, something that is widely welcomed. Moving on. Members will be aware of the intervention SARS has put into a lab travelers to declare before they even get to the airport or the at the moment. So you can essentially declare what your goods are that you're bringing into the country and your accompanied luggage. You can declare anything else that's required to be declared, all using an app. And essentially, you don't have to worry about any paper forms. And the idea here is that's all been done at a sort of voluntary basis up until now. And so now this is then creating the legislative framework to make this then something that can be brought into full production. The other important point here is that it is an important component of ensuring that we get proper foreign currency declarations through this electronic system, which again speaks to the FATF issues that we are addressing as a government as a whole. Moving on. Deferment of duties. So here we're simply aligning the legislation with the Kyoto Convention so that the national legislation makes clear how you do this. This will be done by a set of rules. And so we will then be aligned with the more transparent approach that is required in terms of Kyoto. Moving on. And then taxpayers are sometimes required to lodge a provisional payment for security. And then the question is what do you do with that provisional payment? Sometimes taxpayers don't ask for it back. So how do we get it back to them? How do we deal with these payments that have been made? And so there's a legislative framework being proposed so that we can essentially ensure that these payments in security can be properly dealt with. Again, this is all of these customs interventions have received general welcome. Obviously, there's a good deal of interest in what the rules are going to be saying, and we've committed to putting those out for public comment and following our usual consultative process when the rules are developed. Moving on. Now we're going back into the tax system, and here the idea is that we introduce a definition of beneficial ownership, which is aligned with the other definitions that are used, so that we can gather beneficial ownership information in tax returns, in audits on a consistent basis with the information that is being gathered elsewhere, so that there's an ability to cross-check. And one significant development here was that our approach to our partnership didn't quite work. We got some feedback on that, and so a revised definition of what beneficial ownership means for a partnership has been introduced, and the preliminary feedback that we've received is that this definition works. Makes sense. The previous one had some difficulty. This just essentially expands on why a tax authority would be interested in beneficial ownership. And it's obviously important ensuring that the tax is being properly declared by the right people. So let's move on. Now, Section 18A donations are tax deductible by the donors up to certain limits. And so it's quite important for donors to know that they are dealing with a PBO that has been approved for purposes of issuing such receipts that they can use to claim a deduction. The difficulty is that the current legislation only thinks about PBOs, but if you go to Section 18A, there are a broader range of institutions that, in fact, can issue 18A receipts. As an example, a government department in certain circumstances can do so. Sure that the 18A receipt has been issued by someone who's empowered to do so, and that's the idea behind this amendment, to ensure that SARS can disclose the information in respect of any type of entity that is authorized to issue 18A receipts, so that donors know that they are getting a valid receipt, or at least a receipt that is issued by an institution that is permitted to do so. Moving on. Now that SARS has beneficial ownership information, and I already mentioned that one of the key aspects of this that allows cross-checking between the various holders of beneficial ownership information. And so there's an exception to the secrecy provisions to allow for the disclosure of taxpayer information, which would include beneficial ownership information, to these three entities who hold beneficial ownership information. Moving on. Auto-assessment has been one, and there has been one little issue with it, though, in that if you get an auto-assessment, you have 40 business days to let SARS know if you disagree with it. And given that SARS issues auto-assessments right at the beginning of the filing season, that means you might have to give us your disagreement and the return to underpin your disagreement before the end of the filing season. To keep things more consistent and to reduce confusion, the proposed amendment allows the commissioner to extend that 40 days to the end of a filing season so that there is one filing date for non-provisional taxpayers. You don't have this potential for a different filing date for people who are auto-assessed and people who put a return in and are not auto-assessed. So that's the idea behind this. And we've also taken the opportunity to clarify one of the provisions that some commentators were battling to understand, so that would assist them as well. I think that's the last slide. Move on. Yes, it is. So thank you all very much, and I'll hand back over.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. We're finished from our side.
Thank you, Treasury team. Just say thanks because the network still allows me. Honorable members, there's a presentation from National Treasury. Are there any comments or questions for clarification? Maybe I'll see that in a show of hand. Can you hear me, members?
Yes, Chair. I've got two hands already from Mr. Ryder okay. and Mr. Muletsane.
Okay, it's Honorable Ryder and Honorable Muletsane. Honorable Ryder?
Good morning, Chair, Acting Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Treasury, good morning. Thank you for the presentation, which makes these very technical and difficult to read bills a little bit more understandable. We do appreciate you dumbing it down for us, so thank you for that. And to Chris, congratulations on the acting. And good luck, although I think it may have been a bit of a hospital pass noting the timing. But anyway, let's get into some questions that I have, please. So there are a number of them, and I'm not going to go in any specific order, if you don't mind. I'm going to start with the deferral of the two-pot system implementation and say that this is incredibly disappointing, noting that the proposal was made as partly as a response to the COVID loss of income for many South Africans. And it was a way of ensuring that South Africans have a way of putting food on the table when their income stream had been interrupted. So, you know, I think it's an acknowledgement that there is no point in having a lovely pension scheme, but you starve yourself to death and are not able to access it. So I'm very disappointed by the deferral of this, and I think it is a caving to the big insurance companies. I think Treasury's bending the knee to the insurance companies, and I don't believe that it's a massive difficult thing for them to implement. I think they are all big companies. Hassle to implement this quickly, and especially because it's got a starting date, so it's not retrospective. That's my understanding. Perhaps you can clarify. But because it's got a starting date, it shouldn't be such a big mission to implement the thing going forward. It should be really straightforward. So I'm quite annoyed by the fact that. There's been a request to defer it, and I'm even more annoyed by the fact that the request has been acceded to by the executive. The next question I want to ask just relates to those royalties on oil and gas profits, the fact that it'll be profit-based. Is there a specific kind of table determining what profit, you know, what level of profits is going to be taken into account there? Because, you know, is it going to be EBITDA? Is it going to be bottom line? Because we all know how profits can be manipulated. Just on those telecoms issues with a VAT concern, is that then placing the burden of VAT compliance on the big telecoms provider rather than on the spaza shop owner? If you can just clarify that. That's what I got out of it. If you can just say, am I on the right track there or not? Right. Then we get to those changes to practice note 31 and some of the rebates on interest, etc. You glossed over that in a big hurry, and I want you to unpack it a little bit more for me, because it was a little bit unclear to me if it relates to companies or individuals. From the context, I think it was for companies. And I need to understand that a little bit better, because once again, you know, what qualifies as interest, who charges the interest, becomes very technical when you've got clever auditors setting up complex company structures, group structures, etc. So if you can just unpack that one a little bit for me, please. I really didn't get that piece. Welcoming the grey listing changes, the amendments to ensure that we can comply with those. That APA pilot is certainly welcomed. We would like to know, you know, when the outcome of the pilot happens, We'd love to have that published so that we can see exactly what the outcome is. But also, I think it's important with any pilot project to have some sort of timeline. So, you know, there's nothing so permanent as a temporary arrangement. And I think it's often the case with pilot projects that they become almost semi-permanent and then never broadened, or they kind of just fizzle out and never actually happen. So can you give us some timelines? What are you targeting in order to do an evaluation on that? Again, local employers versus foreign employers, the definition of work is certainly changing, and as is the definition of conducting business in South Africa. And I think that agility is welcomed by SARS, but I think it is something that we need to certainly keep an eye on going forward, because, you know, with electronic transactions, service provision done virtually, et cetera, it's becoming more and more difficult to work out where a company is operating or where an employee is actually working. So yeah, that's something that we're certainly going to need to keep an eye on. Then, Section 45 of the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill is talking about a rebate on fuel. So it's removing a large portion of the road accident fund contribution on fuel. But it says, and I've lost my place in the document, but it says, here we go, it's distillate fuel purchased for use and used in the manufacture of foodstuff as specified and subject to Compliance Note 14. Now, Compliance Note 14, I don't have a copy of in front of me. So, you know, is this going to benefit farmers? How do you define the manufacturing of food? Manufacture of foodstuffs. Is this going to benefit farmers who are not using tractors, combine harvesters, and so on the roads, but they're using it on their farms? So it would make sense for that to happen. And then why are we limiting this only to the manufacture of foodstuffs and not perhaps looking also at generation, noting the substantial costs being absorbed currently, certainly by retailers, large retailers, in terms of having to generate their own electricity to keep the lights on and keep servicing South Africans. It's had a direct impact on the bottom lines of many food distributors. And I think that, you know, we all know that companies don't like to absorb increased costs and they tend to pass these on to consumers. So ultimately, it's you and I that are paying extra for the stuff we're buying in the supermarket, because the generator that's running, we're contributing to the road accident fund. Doesn't make sense. So is there a reason? I'm sure there are many more questions that are going to come out in the next few days as we interrogate this further and maybe get some public participation. But I appreciate the time given, opportunity given. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honourable Ryder. Honourable Mletsane?
Thank you, Chairperson. Please forgive me. I won't be able to switch on the my camera. I'm where I am. It's a rural place, and my reception is very bad.
Like myself.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Let me follow my colleagues to acknowledge the presentation that has been done for us. I just want to check whether on the issue of the illicit trade, has the government made any improvements to fight, to reduce this illicit trade? Whether the government is it fighting and is it winning? There's an improvement in terms of fighting the illicit trading. And then secondly, on the issue of the tobacco industry, they once made a plea for relief from excise duty. Is the government considering the plea, or is it possible to consider it? Okay, thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Honorable Muletsane. Is there any hand? Kulego?
No more hand, Chair.
For more, okay. Okay, thank you very much, honorable members, for the questions and for the and the comments made by you, honorable members. Let me allow National Treasury to respond to all the questions raised by the members.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Maybe I'll start and then hand over to the team. The first one is on the two-part system and the delay. I think we recognize that, you know, we want to get the system in as soon as possible as well, which is why the very ambitious date was initially put in the draft legislation. But the unfortunately, the changes that are required to put the system in are substantial. And it will need a lot of time, not only for industry, but also for SARS, to put the systems in place in order to be able to implement both the withdrawals, but also the allocation of the amounts within the different components, the retirement component, the savings component, and the vested component. We've done a lot of these types of changes to the retirement fund system before. We harmonized all the tax treatment of the different funds. They all had very different tax treatment, and we harmonized it. We put the legislation through, and then we gave industry a year to make the changes in order to implement. Later on, we changed provident funds to a system where they would be required to purchase an annuity at retirement. We put the legislation through, and then there was a year delay, and actually there was an even longer delay before that came in order for the systems to come through. So in all the large personal income tax changes that we do, we always put it in and have a year delay for systems to get ready, for members to know what is actually happening so that they can be educated about the changes that are being made, as well as to align with the tax system and align with the assessments that are made so that you have a tax year where there's only one tax treatment for that tax year. Otherwise, it can get quite complicated and quite difficult. There's just over 3 months until the implementation date in the previous proposal, which would have been very, very tight for administrators such as the GEPF to be able to then allow individuals to access portion of their funds immediately and start allocating those funds between the different components. We don't think that we were bending the knee to these companies by providing an additional delay. This is a very, very large reform that will create a better retirement system that can only have, hopefully, a better retirement outcomes for everybody involved. In terms of the relation to COVID, during COVID, if you were to lose your employment, you can access your pension funds in full. So the individuals who did lose their employment could access those funds in full. And for individuals who didn't, government introduced new measures such as the social relief of distress grant if they didn't have any income to start with. And there were other measures that were put forward as well. So we don't look at this as a purely COVID-related amendment. This is a fundamental reform of the retirement system, and it would be risky to try and rush it, which might undermine confidence in the system. So that is why we put forward the date to 1 March 2025, which was proposed by a lot of the administrators and firms, including the GEPF. The table on the profits to get to 2%, we look at the measure users earnings before interest and tax over sales. So there might be some calculation there, but you know, we think that's an appropriate measure. We can provide some further detail on that, but it is just EBIT over sales. If Haley wants to come in after me, she can. Umpo or Anisa, maybe you could come in on the telecom. And Shansha, if he's there on practice note 31. And then Kukle can come in on the fuel. On the tobacco industry, there have been a lot of efforts by SARS to try and reduce illicit trade here. Those efforts are continuing, and maybe SAS can come in if they would like to. On the excise duty proposal, we have looked at it, but we included an inflationary relief, an inflationary adjustment this year of increasing it to 4.9%. We did that for a few years in a row, so we haven't been pushing up those excise duties above inflation in the last few years. We recognize that illicit trade has become entrenched in that industry, and it might create some difficulties if the excise duty were to increase too dramatically. I'll let my colleagues come in on those other points. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. I'll come in on the VAT issue. The question was whether there's a burden on the big telecom suppliers rather than on the spaza shops on the VAT amendment. Now, it's one of the universally accepted principles of VAT that it must be on the end consumer, and that businesses in between must be left VAT neutral. Now, spaza shops have an output tax to declare if they are registered for VAT, but they have a corresponding input tax for the same amount, which leaves them in a VAT neutral position. The telecom supplier, on the other hand, is left with a position where the supply that they have made has fundamentally changed from a supply that is their own supply to one that a third party is making. And at times, if it was insurance, life insurance, for example, it would be exempt. So the fundamental nature of the supply as well would also be changing. Now, in terms of the VAT provisions, that VAT is due upfront when the supply is made, and not when the consumer then redeems it for anything else. So the problem is that the burden currently is with the big telecom supplier, and that the benefit of two output taxes is with the fiscus right now, whereas it's gaining one output tax from the telecom supplier and one from the third party. And to neutralize that situation for the big telecom supplier, that is why we are proposing that an input tax is claimable by the third party, and it would also ensure that the fiscus does not gain twice. So the spaza shops are in a VAT neutral position right now. Thank you.
Hi, I'll come in quickly on the royalty profit. So Chris mentioned that it is earnings before interest and tax. So, and the denominator is sales. I recognize you mentioned that profits can be played around with, so you're probably concerned about transfer pricing impacts there. So the fact that it's before interest is one of the items that are often come up in the transfer pricing space, as well as sales. But that's a problem we face throughout the business income tax system, and one that SARS is addressing. And so we recognize the concern, but it's also important to balance this with the commercial reality and the cost profiles that these companies will face in deeper waters. So increasing the minimum rate from 0.5 to 2% essentially tries to bring in a low flat rate, but to still have an element of flexibility in the formula. Thanks very much.
Hello, Chris, I can quickly try on the practice note.
Yes, please go ahead.
Thanks. I think Honourable Ryder's question about interest paid on money borrowed refers to the practice note as well. I think the important thing to point out is that it cut across both companies and individuals. And a lot of the comments that came from the public pointed out that while the deductibility is a little bit more clear cut on the corporate side, there can be various circumstances on the individual side that we first have to take into account before withdrawing the practice note. So our proposal was to delay the withdrawal of the practice note in order to look at both individuals and corporations and how they are impacted.
Chris, I can comment on the questions regarding the diesel refund.
Yes, please.
So the question was on the diesel refund system, on whether this would benefit farmers, as well all the agricultural sectors in general, and why this was only, the extension was only limited to the manufacturers of foodstuffs. Now, on the first issue on benefit to farmers, the agricultural sector, forestry and fishing already benefit from the diesel refund system from, I think, 2002. The agricultural sector receives 40% refund on the general fuel levy, as well as 100% refund on the RAF. So farmers or the agricultural sector, forestry and fishing already would benefit from the system. In terms of the extension of the system to the manufacturers of foodstuffs, because the system was is primarily or originally designed for primary sectors, manufacturers of foodstuffs were considered as being in the food sector, sort of the closest proxy to the primary sector, and this would have benefit along the value chain of the sector. And so this is why this was only extended for manufacturers of foodstuffs. In addition to that, there were considerations of the fiscal space of the country, as well as the administrative complexities that are aligned or related to the implementation of the diesel refund system. Because of those issues, we only considered an extension of the diesel refund to the manufacturers of foodstuffs. And I think it's also important to consider that there hasn't been an increase in the fuel levy for the past two budgets in order, you know, to consider the current state of the economy, and the diesel, the fuel levy not being increased has had a significant benefit across the economy and not just to specific sectors. Thank you.
Thanks, Kukle. I think that's on our side. France, do you want to come in on yours?
Thanks, Chris. So just to come in on the APA pilot. So just to reassure the Honourable Member, the Commissioner is very keen on APAs. You'll see it is in our APP. It's in our strategic plan. It was one of the things he, when he walked in the door at SARS for the second time, that he was very enthusiastic about. So there is a great deal of commitment to bringing APAs in, but there is a catch, and that is if you look at the international experience across a number of countries, the time frame for finalizing an APA is between 2 and 3.5 years. Precisely because this is such a complex matter and because of the implications of signing up to an APA, and then obviously also the interactions with other tax authorities that also need to be in the picture and agree to what the result is. So I would think that the pilot is something that would probably have to run for at least 2 years before we could get a sense of what the next step is, because at that point we would have been in a position to negotiate around some APAs and, in fact, start concluding some of them. And at that point, I think there would be learnings. But that is all very much subject to the people who are going to be on the ground. I'm looking at this from a legislative perspective and experience in other countries. That is going to be something that we're going to have to learn from as we do. Fighting illicit trade in the tobacco space. There have been, I think members would be aware that there have been a number of issues where SARS has taken enforcement action that have gotten press coverage. We also have a number of legislative interventions that we've put into place. Members will recall the minimum weight of tobacco products to ensure that what was being received ended up in the product going out the door, and that the loss factors, in inverted commas, couldn't be used for manufacturing other tobacco products. We've also had a move to introduce closed-circuit cameras into the production space and the warehousing and loading space in the industry. That has been met with some resistance, and we are being challenged on that on a constitutional basis, which we are defending. I hope that gives a picture of a revenue service that is certainly well aware of the issues and is engaging with them forcefully. Thanks.
Thank you, Jay. We finished.
Hello. I thought maybe I get cut off. National Treasury, have you all responded to all the questions or the question raised by the members? Okay. Members, are there any follow-ups from the response that was made by Treasury? If all members, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you, Chair. I think that the responses were well received. Thank you. And as I said in my earlier submission, I think we're going to, come up with more questions over the next few days.
Okay, thanks, Honorable Ryder. The thing is, I had to move from where I was sitting so that I don't get any problem with the network. Okay. Gululeko.
Hi, Chair. Sorry, man. I'm just trying to unmute myself. Yes, Chair. I'm here.
Okay. I just want to find out as to, are there any announcement after the presentation made by the National Treasury and the response that they have made? Is there any? Or maybe you can show us the agenda.
Yes, Chair, we have exhausted the agenda okay. In the absence of the follow-up questions. The only announcement that I'm having is that our next meeting will be next Tuesday, Chair, but we'll send all the documentation in due course. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me just thank the National Treasury for the presentation that they made. And to thank you all, to thank even the responses that you have done to make us to understand the text and the and then even though somehow I couldn't hear, but thanks, we'd like to thank you for being with us to come and make the presentation. Thank you very much. We have heard about the announcement for next week. The meeting is going to be, we're going to have a meeting next week. Let me thank you all members for participating in the meeting. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Can the Secretary please put that meeting adjourned in capital letters?
Hello, Ryder.
Minutes, ne?
Hello, Ryder.
No, thank you, Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. See you next week.
Thank you, Chair.